Thank you. Be seated. Justice Hightower is ill, but will participate in the deliberation and decisions of this cause. Justice Gammons will be here momentarily. We welcome juniors from Trinity High School in Midland to the court. There are three. The orders of the court have been announced and are posted outside in the clerk's office and available for your inspection. We have three causes that will be submitted this morning for in oral argument for the court. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Houston versus Williams Construction Corporation and others from Cameron County. Century Insurance versus Golden Moss from Jefferson County. And Betty Parr Russell versus Ingersoll Rand Company from Harris County. After each of these causes, the court will take a brief recess, but we will complete all three arguments before the lunch recess. Counsel in the third causes do not have to remain in the courtroom, but please remain nearby so that we may proceed to your matter without delay. We are recording these arguments auditorily for the convenience of the court. If you wish to listen to tapes of the arguments, you may make application to do so with the clerk of the court. In the first and third causes, the court has allowed 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may discuss with the marshal, reserving an allotted amount of time for rebuttal. In the second cause, we have allotted 15 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Houston versus Williams Construction Corporation.
May I please the court, Daniel Lefkowitz, will present argument for petitioner. With pleasure, I deserve 8 minutes.
May it please the court, all justices, opposing counsel. My name is Dana Lester and I represent the estate of Jane Houston since she is now deceased. Her trial counsel were John Haywood and Ed Stapleton of Costine Stapleton in Brownsville, Texas. I know that you are very familiar with the facts and I will just highlight a few. Basically, First Financial is the party that we are bringing before the court today as far as our portion of the appeal. Robert Williams owns First Financial, controls and directs First Financial, and the wholly owned subsidiary, Williams Construction, who is also here on application for writ of error. The condominium project, the Suntide 3, is the location where Janie Houston slipped and fell and was severely injured. The completion of that project was approximately July of 1982, and in August of 1983, 80% of the units had been sold, and so by contract, they turned over the maintenance to the homeowner association. November of 1986, Jane Houston was injured. May 8th of 1989, she went to trial before the bench. It is interesting to note that First Financial basically took no involvement in the trial or the preparation of trial. First Financial did not investigate, did not supplement discovery, did not attend any of the depositions, did not file any special exceptions, which becomes important as far as their allegations that plaintiff did not specifically plead certain things, but rather referred to the defendants. There were no special exceptions. On May 1st, 8 days before trial, including the trial date as a day, which is proper, they filed a cross action for the first time and it was not allowed. The case went to trial. There was a judgment of approximately $987,000, and there were findings of fact and conclusions of law filed by the trial court. There were no requests that those findings of fact or conclusions of law be altered, amended, or added to.
Counsel, before you proceed, let me just clear something up. There was a jury fee paid in this case?
Yes, there was, Your Honor, and on the day of trial, they asked to waive the jury, and there was no objection to that.
When there's so many parties, using they and it is not very helpful.
I'm sorry. Yes, when the counsel for both Williams Construction and First Financial came, they, on that day, on appearance day, actually on appearance day, the Friday before, their counsel did not appear for appearance day. On the day of trial, their counsel did appear and then asked, is this going to be a trial by jury or before the bench? And they were told it was going to be a bench trial.
We told them.
And there was no, the judge did, Your Honor. And there was no objection. And this was all on the record and as part of the statement of facts. In the pleadings, there were no special exceptions. It was shown through evidence that First Financial had many roles. They were developer, designer, builder, contractor, at times manager, owner of the project, occupier of the project.
Was there any pleading or attempt to prove a breach of the piercing of the corporate veil?
No, Your Honor, that was not addressed. And Mr. Williams, Robert Williams himself, did not attend the trial and did not offer any testimony.
Well, I'm not talking about Williams. Did the plaintiff ever attempt to breach any of these different corporate
entities? Your Honor, that was not planned, and that was not proven at trial.
But there was a claim and evidence to support a claim that First Financial was involved in developing the project.
Absolutely.
And played a role in constructing the area where this fall occurred?
Yes, the only expert witness testified that the developer retains the ultimate right to control both the design and the construction.
So the very deficiency that you were complaining about as having given rise to this fall, you alleged and offered evidence that First Financial created that, had the right to control how it was created.
Yes, Your Honor, and in fact that went undisputed. The Court of Appeals did consider First Financial's liability on the vendor-vendee theory under the Lavaca case, and they went aside from that and then did not address the two other issues and theories that were proven by the plaintiff, and that is that First Financial did create the very danger that injured the plaintiff Houston, and that there was a negligence per se violation of the ordinance where the South Padre Island, through ordinance, had adopted the Southern Building Code. I will first address the negligence per se issues under the Nixon versus Mr. Property case decided by this court in 1985. It basically sets forth the proposition, and subsequent cases have also followed this case, saying that an unexcused violation of a statute or ordinance is negligence as a matter of law. And then the issue becomes one of proximate cause. Here the evidence is undisputed that the Southern Building Code was in effect, that it is set forth for the pure purpose of public safety, public welfare, and the general rights of the public, that it also sets forth specific parameters for handrails, how stairs are to be made, and for the illumination and lighting of those stairways. It was also undisputed that South Padre Island adopted the code. Undisputed that First Financial was the developer, the builder, the designer, the contractor, and, as I just pointed out to Justice Doggett, was that the developer retains the right to control, ultimately, the design and construction. It was also undisputed that the developer must know about the Southern Building Code and must comply with the Southern Building Code. It is also undisputed that First Financial did not, and that there were numerous code violations. Also undisputed was that Janie Houston was injured because of these code violations. In fact, the testimony was any one of the violations could have caused her accident, and the combination of violations assured an accident.
When you say it was undisputed in part because the defendants were not allowed to call any witnesses. Isn't that true?
Yes, and did not develop any of that testimony through cross-examination.
So they were not able to elicit from cross-examination of your witnesses if they weren't negligent.
Your Honor, that was one of the points that was brought before the Court of Appeals.
So to say that it's undisputed on this record assumes the point that the defendants were not allowed to call any witnesses in the first place.
Yes, and also did not identify any expert witnesses on their behalf. It is also undisputed, and even as we sit today, it is undisputed that Janie Houston was within the class of people that the statute and ordinance are supposed to protect. Even as we sit here today, they have not disputed that she is within that class.
You pointed out that the court should be familiar with the facts. We're down now to the green light time. Let's talk a little law. You keep talking about no objections to the findings of fact or conclusions of law.
Yes, sir.
Is the problem there purely that there's seven exhibits that were not included in the statement of facts brought up for the Court of Appeals, or do you claim that there's some doctrine that a complaining party has to make an objection in the trial court over and above, beyond what you would object to a jury finding for in order to preserve error?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't have the rule number on the top of my head. I think it's Rule 298 that says that when there are findings of fact and conclusions of law for a bench trial, that if the other party objects to the format or, and this is briefed in total within my appellate brief, if they object to the format if they object to any of the findings or conclusions, or they want amended findings or additional findings or further findings, that they need to ask for that in writing to the trial court. I believe it's within 5 or 10 days of the filing of the original.
If you want amended findings, but you're claiming if you're not satisfied with the findings, you have to ask for amended findings under Rule 298.
If you want to claim that there are problems because of omitted findings, you cannot claim that there is a problem because a finding has been omitted when you did not ask the trial court to find it.
Ms. Lester, does the record reflect the terms of Ms. Houston's settlement with all parties other than First Financial?
No, Your Honor, it does not.
And that's because First Financial was not allowed to call any witnesses to prove up the terms of the settlement, so they could either elect a credit or to submit the negligence of the settling parties to the fact finder?
Justice Cornyn, actually, the only way that they attempted to do that was to ask the questions to the witness herself. And the plaintiffs objected on that basis and said that's not a proper question for cross-examination.
Ms. Houston would not know the amount of money she received in settlement from the settling defendants?
Your Honor, I don't know on that, but the case law states that the only purpose for doing that is to show bias, like a Mary Carter agreement and that sort. And that was not the purpose.
Well,
they would
be allowed to inquire of the plaintiff outside the presence of the jury the amount of the settlement so they could claim a credit or elect to submit the negligence of the settling parties to the fact finders to have it determined in that manner, wouldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And the proper way that they could have gone about that was to get that information and then file a motion with the court for contribution pursuant to the appropriate sections of under the Civil Practices and Remedies Code, which
they
did not
do. How were
they
to get that information?
I would assume by asking the parties or calling up the settling defendants. That was not ever done.
Well, there was
you subpoena the settling defendants. But it's not proper to ask the plaintiff how much they received. You ask the settling defendants what they paid.
Your Honor, I know that previously I have filed the settlement papers with the court, and I have even filed generic motions saying whatever the amount is, we seek contribution pursuant to the Civil Practices and Remedies Code for a dollar-for-dollar reduction, and none of that was done.
Well, here there was a cross-action filed against the settling defendants, yet it was struck, was it not?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
And it was struck because it was within 7 days of trial?
And technically counting the trial date, then it would be on the 8th day that it was filed.
Yet the settlement occurred 3 days before trial, correct?
Well, the record does not indicate when the settlement was reached. There is nothing to show that there was a settlement on a particular day. It is claimed in the brief of Williams Construction, but it is not of record.
Well, did you non-suit the settling defendants, or how was that handled?
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I can't remember if that's in the transcript or not. I was not involved in the trial court itself. I took over the case on the appeal.
If the settlement did occur shortly before trial, within 7 days, wouldn't it be an abuse of discretion for the trial court not to allow the cross-action so that the non-settling defendant could claim either a dollar-for-dollar credit or elect to have the settling party's negligence submitted to the fact finder?
Well, I know that is Williams Construction and First Financial's position before this court today.
Tell me yours.
I think that it is still, if there is a surprise to the opposite party, which in this case would be the settling defendants, that they have a right to rely on the 7-day rule, and if they check the docket and they check the courthouse 7 days prior and there has been no cross-action filed, then they could reasonably believe that they do not need to be there at time of trial.
If you were the lawyer representing the only non-settling defendant and everybody else settled out 3 days prior to trial, wouldn't you be surprised?
If I was the only non-settling defendant?
Only remaining defendant in the case 3 days prior to trial?
Well, Justice Cornyn, having had that happen to me on numerous occasions, I guess I have come to almost expect it now that at least one or two parties will drop off.
Are you saying that the only way a defendant then can, that all defendants in a multiple party trial must file cross actions against each other well before trial, even if they don't feel they're adverse? And that's just something you're going to have to do. And then if the plaintiff wants to say, look, all these people are pointing fingers at each other, so somebody's guilty, so I win automatically. That's just one of the prices we have to pay for orderly development of a case.
Well, I think it's certainly the prudent thing to do for the lawyer.
Even if you don't feel either side did something wrong, that the Texas Supreme Court should say if more than one defendant sued, the defendants have to claim that each other did something wrong. Is that something we're going to, should we just announce that?
Well, that is the way that the rules are written as far as trying to do an orderly procedure in discovery and pretrial. I do think that there can be exceptions, and I do think in this case, even had there been a cross action, that there certainly can be no harm because the trial court found that the settling defendants were not negligent, and also there was no evidence presented, even the plaintiff's witnesses, and they made no offer of proof or any motions with the court asking for a dollar-for-dollar credit, which is required under the statute. I have not had an opportunity to get much to the Strakos versus Gearing case. My time is up, and I suppose that I should reserve those arguments until after the argument of the Williams Construction and First Financial.
When you come back, explain to us why, if you have not pled for any type of alter ego or piercing the corporate veil, that the Strakos case, whatever it says about Williams Construction, why it's applicable to First Financial as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Yes. May I please report, Mr. Royal Brady will present argument to respondents.
Please, court, I'd like to point out a few things preliminarily. First, as far as this record goes, there is no showing of any settlement with the Homeowners Association, which was, as the record shows, a corporation.
Yeah, if that's true,
association.
Then why didn't you, well, did the defendant ask for findings of the percentage of negligence that should be attributed to these other defendants?
We didn't ask specifically for findings. There were findings. The court specifically found that there was no negligence on the part of anyone other than the present appellees. So as far as the record is concerned, Homeowners Association Incorporated is still a party, and there I can state positively there was no non-suit taken. They just didn't show up at the time of trial. We had heard unofficially that there was a settlement. And we couldn't find out by the ordinary means of requests for admissions of interrogatories because we didn't learn until Friday before the trial Monday or have any intimation that there was any such settlement.
Well, had you filed any interrogatories or requests for production, or was it a situation as suggested by counsel that you filed your denial and then 8 days before trial you filed a cross action and not much happened in between?
Oh, there was a lot happened in between. Just less than a week before we filed our cross action, the Homeowners Association defendants filed a cross action against us. And so it was just 3 or 4 days after they filed theirs that we filed ours.
Did you ever file any interrogatories toward anybody?
No.
Any requests for admission?
No.
Attend any depositions?
No, because we were not a party when all that took place. This suit originally was only against the Homeowners Association.
Well, how long before trial were you a party?
We were made a party substantially before trial, but after the case had already been set for trial. It was about 5 months, I think. But it was clear at that time, since the allegations were mainly of things having to do with maintenance, which had been turned over to the Homeowners Association more than 3 years prior to this accident.
At any time before trial, did you identify any witnesses that are persons with knowledge of relevant facts?
We did not, but the Homeowners Association did file a list of some 21 witnesses, and the cases which we have cited say that any party is entitled to rely on a designation by any other party and call those witnesses. But we were here tonight to call any witness
You knew of no witnesses?
No other witnesses than the ones that had already been
designated.
But
you didn't say no other witnesses. I mean, your answer said we just know of no one.
Well, and then we didn't, because it appeared that we were just added as an afterthought. That since the things alleged were all things like the condition of the carpet, the adequacy of the light bulbs, allowing water to stand on the stairway, things which would all not be the responsibility of a farmer owner.
Well, there was at least one design.
Yeah, that's the only one thing,
if you would address the applicability of Strakos versus Gehring, at least to the construction company.
I did want to point out that there is a jurisdictional point here, in that the points of error now being asserted by these petitioners are not at all the points that were contained in their motion for rehearing. And of course, the cases require that to complain of anything in this court, it must have been specified in the motion for rehearing. And as this court said in the Aviation Office of America against Alexander and Alexander, not only must the point have been assigned as error, but it must have been distinctly specified. And by no stretch of the imagination do the points in the motion for rehearing distinctly specify what is now being set forth in the points of error in the application. Now, the present contention is that First Financial had a whole lot of other hands, that it was not only the owner and developer in the first instance, but that it planned, built, sold, managed, constructed, designed, owned, and occupied the project. Well, that's not so under this record. And of course, by petitioners' own witnesses, because they were the only witnesses allowed to testify. First Financial is a financial institution, not a contractor, not an architectural firm. It was the developer and original owner, but Williams Construction Company was the contractor that did the building, and the design work of the structures was undisputedly, again, by petitioner's own witnesses, by an architect named Rick Lebunski. And First Financial did not manage the project at any time after it turned it over to the Homeowners Association more than 3 years before this accident. It did not occupy the common areas at the time of the accident.
Mr. Brennan, I think the court is fairly well familiar with the facts and with your no evidence points, but
so
at least I'm concerned with how you preserved error. I'm especially concerned with how you preserved error on your procedural claims regarding the settlement, the right to a credit, and the right to file an amended pleading, bringing in
it had been filed. It had been filed. It had been put in the mail about 10 days before and was actually filed on the Monday before the Monday of the trial setting in the clerk's office. It was received, but it was mailed several days before that. And it was struck by the court at the instance of the plaintiffs, not of the defendants it was directed against. And again, we say that they had no standing. The plaintiff had no standing to object to a cross action against someone else.
Did they move to strike the homeowner's cross action against
no.
you?
No, they left
they
that in
surprised.
There.
Did they not claim they were surprised by that?
No. And that was still on file and still is. It's never been withdrawn. The only ground of negligence the Court of Appeals found to be supported was the height of the rail on the outside of this outside stairway. They said it was a couple of inches higher than the code specification, but there's, first place, there's confusion about that, because this is the outside rail, which is a guardrail, and plaintiff's own witness, his expert witness, said that recognized that a guardrail is different under the codes from just a stairway rail, the one on the inside or in the middle, because its purpose is different. It's not to keep people from slipping, it's to keep people from falling over or under from on the outside of a stairway. And more than that, the code was amended shortly after the period when this was built to specify to increase the proper the heights that were allowable and to increase specific limits for guardrails, so that this rail was within the proper limits at the time that this happened, though it was not at the time it was built.
Are you saying that the codes at the time of trial should control?
Well, at least it is evidence that goes into the important thing of whether the violation was a proximate cause.
Well, how about if it's the other way? The code was, at the time of construction, was less restrictive, so it was allowable, but at the time of trial, the code is more restrictive. Would that be evidentiary on causation?
I think it'd be evidentiary, yeah. I don't know, not being an expert in that field, as to whether the change in the code, I suppose it would depend on the terms, whether it applied to existing structures and required you to go in to make changes, which it could, or only applied to new structures. I think that's usually specified. But anyhow, it is further not established whether the height, what the error of an inch or two was on the part of the architect in giving wrong specifications, specifying it to be that height, or whether Williams Construction departed from specifications in the plan, and it would appear to be likely to be the latter, because plaintiff's expert said that there was a variation of the height above the rail above the tread of several inches from one spot to another, which would indicate.
I realize that you're seeking a rendition of judgment rather than a remand. That your claims here are, you're trying to make an argument for no evidence. But if the plaintiff shows, proves that this design was outside, so what? Well, if there is some evidence of proximate cause, isn't it your burden to show some type of excuse that it's a third
Of course, the plaintiff
party,
herself did not attribute her slip to anything about the handrail, other than she said the case that she couldn't reach it. She had her hand on it, said it felt like it had grease on it.
But there's also some testimony that the higher a handrail is, the less support it is.
Only
when somebody starts tripping or slips on something.
But by an expert who was not expert in that field. He was an engineer, and he knew about what the code said, but he was really not in a position to say what that would cause physically to a person walking down.
And you objected to that testimony. It was overruled, and you preserved error on that objection.
There were some, I don't recall exact objections, but we say that Beal against Lobaca is not limited to transfers of legal title. That case itself, it was a lessor, lessee, and the lessee just turned the property back to the lessor. So there wasn't a change of legal title. And in this against Inman, the government that transferred the premises had also created the condition, the dangerous condition. but this rule is still applied. It's the transfer of possession and the right of control which is determinative. And
is it,
in the first place,
can we tell from this record exactly what interest in ownership, control, and possession were transferred from First Financial to the homeowner?
We know that more than 3 years before, 80% at least had been sold. And it would certainly follow that in the next 3 years, it was likely that most of the remaining 20% had been. And again, it's the burden of proof is on the plaintiff to show, if they so contended, that the defendant still owned whatever amount of the property that they contended it still owned. But that is not in the record. It doesn't establish that.
Do the homeowners, do the condominium owners under the document own an interest in the common area, or do they just have the right to use it?
The individuals have a right to use it. The Incorporated Homeowners Association had legal title and the duties of maintenance and control and possession
of the
common areas.
And the actual condominium owners only have the right to use it.
Right. And again, if it were established that a certain number of condominiums were still owned by First Financial, their position would just be as any other owner who was a member of this incorporated association, and it's important that it is a corporation. And if there has been a settlement with it, then presumably that settlement would settle all of the individual's potential liabilities too. But not having been able to inquire into it, we couldn't find that out. The cross action, both cross actions.
Let me be sure I understand that. Even if First Financial owned every last condo out there, after the transfer, when the 80% sale took place, when that level was reached, was that a transfer of ownership to the homeowners association of the common areas?
Of the common areas, yes. As to Strakos against Gehring, that, of course, overrules a previous doctrine that a contractor is relieved of duties to the general public after acceptance of work by the owner. But here, of course, it's Williams Construction Company that was the contractor, and its work would be accepted by First Financial as the owner. So First Financial was never in the position of contractor, and it has never relied upon the accepted work doctrine, which
Isn't there some evidence in the record that First Financial was actively engaged in the design and planning of
testimony by this so-called expert who was an engineer that had testified on everything else to that a developer would have a legal right to do this, that, and the other. But he had no particular knowledge of what the situation was as to this developer and this contractor. So we say Strakos does not involve the restatement of tort sections applicable here and is not contrary to the Beal against Lavaca line of cases. There still could be liability on the part of a former owner and developer if it knew about specific defects and either concealed them or did not reveal them and the new owner didn't know about them. But there's no such showing here. There's no evidence of, in the first place, that First Financial knew anything about the exact height of this rail, nor that it did anything to conceal it, because there the rail was out in full view for more than 3 years to all of the employees and directors of the Homeowners Association. As to the cross action, as I said, less than the appellees here filed their cross action less than a week after they received the cross action by the Homeowners Corporation against them. And it did not adopt, it did not allege any new allegations of negligence against the Homeowners Association. Those had been adopted, had been alleged by the plaintiffs in the first place. This was just something which would legally result, depending upon what the facts would be found to be in that respect, on the plaintiff's own allegations. So there was no room for surprise. In fact, there are cases, including federal cases in, from Texas in this situation, that say you can amend and file a cross action. You can file a cross action after a verdict, even where it does nothing other than allege a legal result from issues which have already been tried and found. So certainly there was no room for surprise here.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May I please support Ms. Lester and not to everybody?
Just a couple of minor points. First, in answer to your question, there were no objections to the expert's qualifications at any time. Also, there was evidence that First Financial continued to have ownership interest because they were a member of the Homeowners Association, and only condominium owners can be members of the Homeowners Association.
Are you saying then that any condominium owner has the potential of being totally liable for any actions that happens in the common area?
Absolutely not. What I am saying is that First Financial's role, aside from the homeowners, whether they're negligent or not negligent, aside from the percentage owned by any of the homeowners, that under Strakos versus Gearing, that we are asking this court to say, yes, that is also controlling, and where First Financial creates the danger and leaves the premises in an unsafe condition, that it cannot simply slip out of liability and responsibility by saying under contract they now maintain the common areas. And that contract does not eliminate their duty of care under Strakos versus Geary. Now, it is a contractor case, but this court also in the City of Denton versus Van Page considered that doctrine in light of a fire marshal and said the fire marshal did not create the danger in the storage house that blew up because there was gasoline enclosed. Therefore, the fire marshal will not be considered liable in the City of Denton because that danger was not created by the City of Denton. And then an appellate court, the Houston 14th District in Davis versus Esperado Mining, also looked at the Strakos versus Gearing doctrine, not with contractors, but said when you create the danger and it's shown that your creation of the danger then injures someone and that that injury is foreseeable, that you cannot simply escape liability and be immune from suit and having an obligation.
To what extent do you think, is it your position that the restatement second of tort sections 351 to 353 correctly state Texas law?
I think that it is a correct statement. I think that the Lavaca case is very distinct from this situation and from Strakos versus Gearing, which was just also articulated by Royal Brin. He said that they are different situations when it's a pure vendor of the land.
And these sections would apply, I take it, to any sort of liability, whether it were based on negligence or negligence per se.
I think that those sections amply consider all the different alternatives that may arise between a pure vendor who owns the land and then sells it. But that is not simply the role of First Financial here. And they may object now to say that the expert witness, Mr. Freeland Wiley, was not qualified to make all this testimony, but there was no objection then to his qualifications.
But the Court of Appeals seemed to just assume that those sections of the restatement accurately stated Texas law, and you have no quarrel with that.
No, we really do not have quarrel with that. Our quarrel was that they didn't consider our theories of liability under the Strakos versus Gearing and the Nixon versus Mr. Property. And all that...
Which would apply only if 351, 352, and 353 are not invoked, I think. If only if First Financial is not a vendor.
If First Financial was purely a vendor, I would think that the Lavaca case would control. But I don't think that the evidence supports that. And on the jurisdictional issue, just so I can point that out, we did make reference to our brief as appellee before the Court of Appeals, and our two points of error are exactly Part A and Part B under our first reply point that we incorporated by reference.
Let me explore something here. I'm very bothered by the fact that most of the trial court's findings regarding liability seem to go purely to what was done after the Condominium Association took over. That is, the carpet, the light. And then the trial court makes a finding that only First Financial and Williams were guilty of any type of negligence. Now, I know that you have preservation of error points all the way through, or failure to properly cross-plead, plead a third-party liability. But aside from all that, if not for these waiver arguments, is there any way that those findings can be reconciled?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that they can. The findings by the trial court on the carpet, first of all, as far as the illumination, the lighting, that by design was never altered. And the criticisms were as to the design and it being out of building code specification. Now, as to the carpet, the identical carpet was installed, and there was testimony that it was then foreseeable that because they have all of these floors on this big condominium project, that they would replace it with identical carpet so that it looks the same and it's easier to keep track of. Now, I think that the difference is when you're talking about the cause and fact, whether you go under Nixon and that there's an unexcused violation of the statute, or Strakos and saying that they created the danger, you're still looking at proximate cause. We're not talking about any absolute liability here. You still have to go back to the basic fundamentals of negligence, which is our position that the record supports. At any rate, when you go back to that, you've got the but-for, the carpet, is that what made her fall? And I think that the trial court's findings, although they say, yes, it wasn't properly maintained, that the testimony was that I don't think the carpet is slippery. I think it is still skid-proof.
I mean, you're negligent in having water standing on the carpet, but that was not a proximate cause of the fall.
That's not but for why she was injured. And I think that the trial court found that because of the improper design and putting together the handrails, the fact that the stairs were uneven, the treads and risers, I think they call it, and also the illumination, that those combined assured an accident with the testimony, and that that is but for those code violations, this would not have occurred. And there is absolutely no question that First Financial created that danger and left that premises in an unsafe condition. It was pointed out by Mr. Brin that the Court of Appeals did not criticize anything except the improper placement of the handrail. And on page 13 of the opinion, it also says the trial court could have and apparently did find that appellants, including First Financial, caused the injury by improper placement of the handrail and other defective construction methods which had been previously identified by the court. In answer to your question before, I had sat down before, Chief Justice, some of the language in Strakos, when it's talking about acceptance of defective work should not be a legal excuse for the negligent performance of that work, nor for leaving the premises in a dangerous condition. And also the basic premise of negligence and the law of negligence, every person responsible for injuries which are the reasonably foreseeable consequence of his acts or omissions is responsible. There is no doubt that First Financial could reasonably foresee that people like Janie Houston would be visiting the condominium project in a resort area on South Padre Island. There is nothing to show that First Financial would not reasonably foresee that the building code violations are going to increase the dangers on that stairway, and that by increasing the dangers, that it then becomes more dangerous. If I may, just because of many questions, just cite one passage out of this court's El Chico Corporation case.
Won't you just give us the reference?
All right, Your Honor. It's on page 311, and it talks about duty being the threshold inquiry and citing back to the Buchanan versus Rose case of 1942.
Any questions?
And the site 732 Southwest 2nd 306.
One last question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why were you surprised by the cross-action against these defendants, but not the cross-action against them?
Your Honor, the cross-action from the homeowners to the appellants was filed more than 8 days. And I'm not saying that the plaintiffs themselves were surprised that defendants would be filing cross-actions. What I'm saying is that the rule, when it says operates as a surprise to the opposite party, I would think that that would be in a cross-action, the settling defendants.
Well, then why was there no motion to strike it then?
To strike the cross-action?
Against these defendants, as opposed to the one by them.
I would assume that that's because since they had settled and had seen no cross-action filed within the 7 days, that they did not come to trial and then could not make that objection.
How did you have standing to object to that, to any third-party action between defendants?
Well, that's an interesting question that was raised for the first time by the appellants to the Court of Appeals and not to the trial court. And perhaps the trial court would have ruled differently had they raised that before the trial court.
Your position is that's waived.
Well, I don't want to say that it's waived. I think that it's proper to ask the court to take judicial notice that the settling defendants are not there because under the rules they did not expect a cross action to be filed and did not come to participate.
Any other questions? That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.